Hello and welcome to The Bulletin with UBS on Monocle 24. Each week we'll be hearing from the sharpest minds and freshest thinkers in the world of finance, taking you beyond the numbers and the hype and getting to the heart of the big issues of the day. This week we're looking to the Korean Peninsula, just over a week since a truly historic day of meetings, diplomacy and pledges to move towards an end to the seven-decade-long conflict between North and South. We're going to hear our panel's verdict on the meeting between President Kim Jong-un and Moon Jae-in. We'll ask how much we should read into the covenants undertaken by the respective administrations. We'll track what the market made of the moves that day, and we'll ponder what we can expect as we look further into the future. We start with some reactions to the well-documented meeting that took place between the respective presidents at the demilitarized zone on Friday the 27th. Jason Strother, Monocle's correspondent in Seoul, was following the story closely. Here's his view.
There were many lofty goals in the joint declaration. President Moon Jae-in and ruler Kim Jong-un vowed there would never be another Korean War. The leaders also pledged to strive for a peninsula free of nuclear weapons. But what wasn't in the fine print was whether Kim Jong-un would give up the weapons he's already made. No one here expected that the summit, the third of its kind, though the first to be held in South Korea, would result in a breakthrough. But after a very tense year, when it seemed that war between the United States and North Korea was inevitable, most people are just happy to see leaders sitting down at the table and not threatening to annihilate one another. Even though Kim didn't come to the border pushing a wheelbarrow filled with ballistic missiles, he did come loaded with a charm offensive. From that opening handshake across the border in the DMZ, he tried endearing himself to South Koreans. He grabbed Moon by the hand and dragged him back to North Korea, not to abduct him, but for a photo op before returning to the South to start the summit. He joked with President Moon about no longer having to wake him up early in the morning because of his missile tests, which he says are now over. Kim wants South Koreans to see him as a nice, funny guy and not the monster who had his elder brother knocked off or who oversees a system of gulags. A more tangible agreement that the two leaders made was the resumption of family reunions. These are get-togethers for people who haven't seen relatives across the border since the time of the Korean War. These folks are now in their 60s, 70s, and 80s, and thousands pass away every year. It's been 3 years since the last time such an event was held. Kim and Moon have set the date for the resumption of these meetings for August 15th, the day that both Koreas celebrate their 1945 liberation from Japan. It's a symbolic gesture that will go over well for Koreans on both sides of the DMZ.
John Everard was the UK ambassador to Pyongyang between 2006 and 2008 and is a regular voice of authority and good sense on the peninsula for Monocle 24. We spoke with John on the day of the meeting itself to get his initial reactions. John Everard, should we take Kim's calls for a new history on the peninsula seriously?
That is a question everybody's asking and nobody can answer. At the moment, it's all looking good, isn't it? But then the North Koreans would make sure that it looks good. We just don't know, because we know that his father cheated repeatedly on agreements, but nobody's ever tested Kim Jong-un himself on this. Maybe the guy could be trusted. Maybe he's serious. I think that the motto that the South Koreans are working to is hope for the best, but prepare for the worst. Proceed with the greatest caution.
Now, John, we had plenty of bellicose rhetoric mere months ago. So why such a change?
Well, of course, President Trump is claiming this is all down to his wise policy of applying maximum pressure. And sure enough, that may well have been a significant factor in the North Korean decision. But I think there were probably other factors too. Firstly, the North Koreans claim that they now have a meaningful nuclear deterrent. So they probably feel that for the first time they can negotiate with the South Koreans, the Americans, even the Chinese from a position of strength. Other factors that we have a new president, of course, in South Korea. President Moon Jae-in has not been in office that long, and he is much more liberal than his predecessor. So the North Koreans probably saw a window of opportunity. Also, things we can't see. Maybe things going on inside Pyongyang. Maybe Kim Jong-un, having got rid of all his potential opponents, now feels strong enough to make big, bold gestures.
Jason Dreo is UBS Head of Tactical Asset Allocation for the Americas. Jason, from your vantage point there, what did you take away as you watched events that had until recently seemed so unlikely unfolding? Did it throw up any questions? And if so, Jason, what are they?
How much should we put into what was been announced? Like, you know, it's easy to do a symbolic handshake. It's another to actually make substantial changes. And that's going to be where, you know, kind of the rubber hits the road over the next few months and the rest of this year. So one, how is this actually going to play out? Is it a real substantial development, or is it just something that is symbolic and another potential false start? The second then is, if this is a positive development, which, you know, incrementally it certainly is, what does this mean sort of for the investment outlook? Does it change kind of how we think about things if North Korea as a geopolitical risk starts to diminish or go away entirely? I think the conclusion there would be it has a very modest impact on like how investors would be viewing, you know, things overall, in part because they'd become a little bit numb to sort of the rhetoric back and forth between President Trump and the North Korean regime overall. I think they'd sort of discounted the overall potential impact this would have. So very small probability of something, you know, very bad happening. So something for, by and large, that investors ignored. The third thing that I considered, I think, where it could perhaps be the most relevant, and this is to be determined, is what is the sort of the corollary effects of this announcement? And in particular, what does it mean for the U.S.-China relationship?
John Nilsson Wright is Senior Research Fellow for Northeast Asia at Chatham House. John, to this broader point, Jason Dreo raised it there. Can we trust North Korea? Or perhaps more accurately, can we trust the leadership?
I think it is significant that we saw Kim Jong-un take a great political risk and a risk to his own security by stepping onto South Korean soil. I think it's important to emphasize the extent to which in his public remarks, even if Kim Jong-un didn't explicitly mention denuclearization, he certainly made a commitment to adhere to and enforce previous agreements. This is a reference, of course, to those past summits in 2000 and 2007, and even going back to 1991, when North and South Korea signed a non-aggression treaty. In the past, North Korea has been criticized for breaking the terms of those past agreements, and therefore I think making that commitment is a sign, in principle, of good faith. Of course, the devil is in the details. Of course, there is a difference in terms of interpretation about denuclearization. And of course, logically, if you look at the North Korean position, you have to ask yourself, why would North Korea give up its nuclear weapons? They represent the only insurance policy that the North has, that it won't be attacked by the United States. They're a source of legitimacy for Kim Jong-un, and of course they're enshrined in the North Korean constitution. I think the key in this declaration is the idea of sequencing, of a phased approach to disarmament. That's the language that's used in the agreement. And that reflects, I think, the aspiration of the North Korean leadership to play for time. The very least that they want is to find a way of distracting the United States from going back to the military option. And in that sense, they share the same perspective of the South Korean government, which is desperate to avoid anything that might lead to conflict. For obvious reasons, it would be devastating to the two Koreas. So a common interest on the part of the Koreas to keep these negotiations going. And one of the big differences from 2000 and 2007 is that this agreement has been signed pretty much at the beginning of President Moon's term in office. And therefore, he has more time to continue these negotiations. Whether that's an agenda or a timetable that's going to meet the aspirations of Donald Trump, of course, is another thing altogether.
Let's get the UBS view from the APAC region next. Minlan Tan is head of the Asia Pacific Investment Office at UBS Wealth Management CIO in Singapore. Minlan Tan, what did you take away as you watched the events unfold, and indeed as you heard what the respective sides had to say that day?
I think the Inter-Korea Summit quite probably is the single best geopolitical news event of the year so far. It is indeed a major step towards ending the 70-year conflict on the peninsula. And I would say that in the near term, we are seeing some de-escalation of geopolitical tensions. But having said that, we have been here before. In fact, I would say that we've been here six other times since the first Inter-Korea Summit in the June of the year 2000. So I guess it's no surprise that the market reaction so far, both with regards to the Korean won as well as with regards to the Kospi, has actually been quite muted. So I would say that it is good news, but we still have to watch further developments going forward.
Still to come on the Bulletin with UBS, we'll look to the markets and we'll ask our experts to ponder what the future might hold. Looking to the markets next. Previous flare-ups on the peninsula, thinking back to the North Korean missile tests last year, for example, haven't really given the market jitters. The average single-day decline in South Korean equities, for example, was but 0.1%. Jason Dreyo, let's talk about that. Is that because you and your colleagues and others focus on the fundamentals, focus on the economics rather than the politics?
Well, the politics are very difficult to calibrate. So, you know, 6 months ago, I think we had a conversation where we might have talked about this, and I would have been, the chances that 6 months later we would have seen what happened last Friday would have seemed like a very remote possibility. So the fact that it did happen suggests like this, that tells you how difficult it is to kind of calibrate political developments. And so if you can't really calibrate it very well, it's hard to have a lot of faith in your investment decisions based around them. So where you can have more confidence is to look at, you know, what does the economic environment look like, whether it's the U.S., in Korea, just globally overall, calibrate that, and then start to think about if the situation in North Korea escalates in some way, what is the impact on the economic fundamentals, which we have more confidence in predicting. And even if there's a lot of escalation and tension and back and forth rhetoric, but no real economic impact, then it's not something that you want to make investment decisions around as a base case. And even in a very remote case of something being, let's say, kind of more of a catastrophic kind of outcome, again, it's difficult to set a position for that. So that's not something investors did. And I think that's why when you saw these very muted reactions, even in South Korean equities, which would be the most directly impacted, but if anything escalated with North Korea, why it was almost kind of shoved off as something that's kind of largely irrelevant. Because it's almost, you know, impossible to kind of calibrate how things would evolve.
Min Lan Tan, you mentioned the markets before. If we look to markets, previous flare-ups on the peninsula haven't really given the markets jitters. In your view, is that because of a focus on economics rather than politics?
I would say that you are right in saying that fundamentals, corporate as well as macro, would matter more for the Korean markets as well as for the Asian markets in general. It's also because I think the tail risk of a all-out war is actually really quite low. So even during the period of escalation and provocation, the market reaction was actually very muted.
Let's consider this from the investor viewpoint next. Jason Dreyo, can you tell us more about the bank's position here? UBS remains overweight in emerging market equities, even though, of course, some positions, I guess, are held to protect against tail risks. Is that right?
That's correct. So I think, you know, when we can look at the economic fundamentals, we still have a very constructive view on the global economy. There has been some kind of moderation in the past 4 months. So from a period where last year growth was sort of accelerating, exceeding expectations, kind of surprising to the upside, for the first 4 months of this year, we've seen at least a moderation of the growth, not sort of surprising as much. I think that's contributed some of what we've seen in terms of the market performance, you know, equities being relatively flat for the year. But moderation doesn't mean slow. So, you know, different gauges have gone from very, very high levels to high levels. And sometimes it's that sort of that second order effect of that change, the rate of change that matters more for markets than the absolute level, at least on a short-term basis. On a kind of more of a cyclical view, those levels do matter. They're still kind of positive. That sort of for us justifies our overall kind of, you know, position, as you mentioned, overweight equities, overweight emerging market equities. Clearly, the things that we would worry about would be more of how this cycle evolved. In the U.S. in particular, will we see signs of inflation continuing to pick up? Will it force the Federal Reserve to raise interest rates faster than we in the market expect? Could that cause a slowdown in growth, hit corporate earnings? Things such as the geopolitical risks is something, again, we kind of calibrate and think about. Our market's properly pricing that in. But unless it looks like it's going to dramatically alter sort of some of the fundamentals, it's more of a risk case scenario that we could hedge with different positions, but it's not sort of the base case kind of, you know, risk overweighting allocation.
Finally on the program, let me come back to you, John Everard, with a complicated and yet simple question. What's next?
Don't know. I think the White House will be sucking its teeth as it reads this statement. President Trump indicated as late as yesterday that we should not take for granted that the second summit in this series of three, of course the summit between him and Marshal Kim Jong-un, will go ahead. I don't think that statement will encourage him. I think there's a real risk that this process now gets off the rails.
And a final thought from you too, Min Lan Tan. I guess we do indeed need to look ahead to the prospective meeting of Donald Trump with Kim later.
We are all looking out for what could come out of the Trump and Kim summit, but I do think that there are some analysts who believe that the detente on the Korean Peninsula has increased the risk of a trade war, or that it has increased the leverage that the United States has over China in the trade negotiations. Actually, my own perspective is that I would be quite careful with that characterization, because I do think that one should not be conflating the trade issues with the Korean issue, because the calculus for trade and for the long-term security situation on the Korean Peninsula are really quite different, especially for China. I think China will concede to some trade measures simply because they do know that the playing field is not exactly equal today, and they are quite sensitive to the political pressures in the United States. But when it comes to the Korean Peninsula, it's quite unlikely that China will concede influence over the Korean situation to the United States. So yeah, I don't think that one should conflate the two issues between trade and North Korea.
And that's Min Lan Tan bringing us to the end of this 187th edition of The Bulletin with UBS, setting the agenda in the fast-moving world of finance each week here on Monocle 24. Listen again and find out more at monocle.com or catch up via your preferred platform. The Bulletin with UBS on Monocle 24.